everyone. It's Wednesday, hump day, December 4th. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes in this overcast, cool day. But you don't know because you're in front of the TV set. You are watching the impeachment. You have no clue to what's going on outside there. You're listening to law professors talk. I have to admit, at least three of the four were absolutely mesmerizing. Two I agreed with, the other one I didn't, but they were charming and smart and passionate and folksy in a good way, and they told a great story, and it was hard to come to the radio station is what I'm trying to tell you.
Yes,
anyway, we're gonna do a variation on the theme at 12:30. So if just in case you don't read, we're gonna read to you. This is going to be story hour on The Attitude. Don't you love it?
Oh, you're going to love it.
Oh, you are. Of course. Anyway, so on this December 4th, this hump day, what's floating your boat?
Arnie, I want to read a poem, and I want to dedicate it to you and others like you who are inspirations to all of us.
Where's my shovel? Okay. Is that the title of it?
Where's my shovel?
Where's my shovel? Okay.
No, the poem is called Continue, and it's by Maya Angelou.
Continue.
My wish for you is that you continue. Continue to be who and how you are, to astonish a mean world with your acts of kindness. Continue to allow humor to lighten the burden of your tender heart. Continue in a society dark with cruelty to let the people hear the grandeur of God in the peals of your laughter. Continue to let your eloquence elevate the people to heights they had only imagined. Continue to remind the people that each is as good as the other and that no one is beneath nor above you. Continue to remember your own young years and look with favor upon the lost and the least and the lonely. Continue to put the mantle of your protection around the bodies of the young and defenseless. Continue to take the hand of the despised and diseased and walk proudly with them in the high street. Some might see you and be encouraged to do likewise. Continue to plant a public kiss of concern on the cheek of the sick and the aged and infirm, and count that as a natural action to be expected. Continue to let gratitude be the pillow on which you kneel to say your nightly prayer, and let faith be the bridge you build to overcome evil and welcome good. Continue to ignore no vision which comes to enlarge your range and increase your spirit. Continue to dare to love deeply and risk everything for the good thing. Continue to float happily in the sea of infinite substance, which set aside riches for you before you had a name. Continue, and by doing so, you and your work will be able to continue eternally.
Wow.
I love you, Arnie Arneson.
Thank you so much. What's that one about continue the public kiss? I would read that line again. I like the public kiss. That's kind of how I feel like running for office is a public kiss. Isn't that funny? That's how I see it as a public kiss.
Well, also doing this show and sharing ideas with people. It's like a conversation with the public. Continue to plant a public kiss of concern on the cheek of the sick and the aged and infirm, and count that as a natural action to be expected.
Wow. That's lovely. That line right there, in 1984 when I ran for the legislature, I ran on health care to address the needs of part-time workers and people who couldn't access health care. That was my raison d'etre. And it was my public kiss because I saw so many people slipping through the cracks and I realized the consequences were just enormous. And I'm looking at 2019 and they're still slipping through the cracks. We need a lot more public kisses, people. Let's go.
But with this line and others in the poem about, you know, counting this as a natural action to be expected of everybody. Your example is – we should all be doing this. We should all be caring about other folks and doing anything we can to help people, including people who are vulnerable, especially people who are vulnerable.
Well, you know, we're going to be joined right now by David Dayan from the American Prospect, and he is the new executive editor, and now he's got the responsibility of keeping this little sort of progressive magazine afloat. So he's recognizing sort of he's always known what's happened to journalism and the media, but now in a lot of ways he has a greater sense of responsibility. So we're going to talk to him a little bit about what he's trying to do to keep the American Prospect afloat, but then we're also going to talk about Bloomberg. because Bloomberg is also about a form of journalism. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to understand that because I think he has something like 7,200 reporters around the world. Did you know? That's how big
Good
they
grief.
Are. So, not only is he a billionaire multiple times, not only is he running for president, can buy the election, and I'm beginning to see him buying the numbers as his numbers creep up.
Yeah, he's up to 5%.
But more importantly, you need to know what's happening to Bloomberg News. And that's a really interesting story, too, that David tells. So a public kiss to David Dayan, who joins us shortly. But before we grab David, I do want to – you know, I had an interesting conversation this morning. I tried to get this guy from – I saw an article. I think it was the Yale Climate Connection or something like that. And it was about energy storage. And you know me. I'm the battery queen. I love the idea of storage. And part of the reason why I like the idea of – you know, addressing the issue of storage, whether it's storage of wind or storage of solar or whatever it is, that we can somehow be able to tap into it, not just when the sun shines or when the wind blows, and therefore it becomes really a sustainable form of alternative energy, is that I said to the guy this morning who said he would join me today, but I said, no, we got something else up our sleeve. Join me next week. But I said, I love your story. And I said, the reason I love your story is, you know, I'm looking at something that says global greenhouse gas emissions will hit yet another record high this year, experts project. And then here's what one of the authors at the Washington Post said. We're blowing through our carbon budget the way an addict blows through cash. And as I was talking to the guy who will be joining us next week about storage, I said, you know, I have historically believed in the democratization of energy. I want us all to be able to produce our own energy, one, because I think it's important for us to have that connection to what it is that we need and how we use it. Two, I think it's also a security issue because we're not going to be on any grid and we're all going to have this a little bit of autonomy and protection. I think it also means that because we'll be able to, through democratization of energy, be able to use the alternatives, the beauty of democratization is this. Nobody controls the sun. Nobody controls the wind. They do control fracking. They do control coal. They do control oil and gas, but not the sun and the wind, and not conservation. That you can access, and anywhere on the planet you can address it. So there are a lot of there's almost a libertarian sense of a connection to that. But I said that's one of the reasons why I want to talk about your storage article is that I think it's an article of hope. And he goes, well, qualified hope. I said, hey, you know, I'll take hope any way we get it. So he'll be joining us next week, and you'll understand why I said no at the last minute because I had something else up my sleeve. Anyway, I went to the American Prospect. There is a new article. Everyone go to the prospect.org. And so I went to the prospect.org, and he'd written about, you know, his concern about journalism. And then he'd written a piece about Bloomberg and his concern about Bloomberg entering the race and the message that was sent to his reporters and editors that that means that now not only will they not cover him and his family, but because he's running on the Democratic ticket, that his newspaper organ, the Bloomberg News, will not cover any of the other candidates. Well, then I saw another article that was posted today, and it is really interesting what Bloomberg is doing. You create the illusion that he's pulling this arm's length relationship by not, you know, letting his reporters and editors cover the Democratic primary because he's involved in it. But in an interesting way, they are really also, I think, laying a foundation for him to run on in the sense that they are bringing in these experts and these people from within the Democratic Party who are very closely related to what? The Democrats' moderate corporate agenda. So in a way, he's already tipped the scales with Bloomberg News because he's telling them, one, you can't look here, but then he's laying a foundation where you think you're getting arm's length news and information, but it's going through a certain lens. And I thought that that was really important because as we watch the Bloombergs of the world come out there with their $53, $54 billion, deciding to not participate in any of the debates because they don't need to, deciding to ignore the early states because they don't need them, being able to go into the Super Tuesdays because they can afford them, you have to start asking yourself, what does it mean if the Democrats end up nominating someone like a Michael Bloomberg? What does it mean about who we are, who we represent, And what is the value of democratic institutions and the idea of exercising the franchise that isn't bought and sold? I mean, I really do think this is a real test of not just my party, but this is a real test of democracy. So it'll be fascinating to talk to Dave. But these are the issues that I think about all the time. And I am really worried about what's happening to our local media. I'm going to be doing WGBH. I'm taping the show tomorrow. And one of the things I do for WGBH is I do a show called Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. And one of the things I'm required to do is pull stories out from Vermont, Maine, and New Hampshire. I'm sort of the three little states. I'm responsible for that. And then she gets someone from the Cape, and then she gets someone from Rhode Island. So that's the sort of under-the-radar story. What was so shocking for me as I was pulling together my stories was that I noticed that most of the stories that I was pulling up for New Hampshire and for Vermont, for New Hampshire, it wasn't from the Concord Monitor because they don't have that much of the Concord Monitor anymore. It wasn't from the Union Leader because they don't have that much of the Union Leader anymore. What was it from? It was from New Hampshire Public Radio. All my local content was from New Hampshire Public Radio, a nonprofit that was doing it. Where was my content from? From Vermont? Vermont Digger, VT Digger. It's really, really interesting, the changing journalism mode. Anyway, joining us right now is the executive editor, the relatively new executive editor of the American Prospect. I want to welcome David Day into the program. And David, I want you to first talk about the original reason I sort of reached out to you, which was, you know, it was Giving Tuesday, and everybody's like asking for money, just like you. You're a nonprofit. But you really took this story and just sort of said, this is who we are. This is why we're necessary. This is what's happening in the world of journalism. If you don't invest in us, think of what you lose.
Welcome. Absolutely.
So let's talk a little bit about that story. Go on.
Yeah, I mean, thank you for bringing me on to talk about this. I mean, I think everybody knows that the industry of journalism is going through a tough moment.
Very.
We've lost 7,200 journalists this year. About 15,000 last year. Information deserts are a threat to good government, a threat to an informed citizenry, a threat to so many things. And at this time, what I've been trying to do in my first 6 months at the American Prospect is to actually expand, to go against the grain and build something to get to the point where I could go to people and say, yes, this is something worthwhile. This is something worth your support, worth you getting involved with and investing in.
Yeah.
And I feel like we've gotten there. And so, you know, we put together a series of ways for people to get involved with their support, whether at a small, you know, $3 a month level, or a higher level that enables you some additional perks, access to events, access to conference calls with us, and various other things that really invest you and engage you in the magazine and its content, both in print and online, where we're trying to expand our reach and bring you as much coverage about ideas, politics, and power as we possibly can. And, you know, our overhead's low. Every dollar that people give gets plowed right back in. And so the place to go for that is prospect.org/subscribe. And, you know, this is kind of a shameless pitch, but it has a serious point that, you know, democracies don't survive very well without news, without the press,
and that's why
without a free press.
Right, and you didn't hear me, but what I was saying as you were about to come on the air is, so I'm getting ready for WGBH with my stories from New Hampshire, Vermont, and Maine, and I suddenly realized that for the first time ever, virtually all my stories were from VT Digger, a nonprofit in Vermont, and almost all my stories from New Hampshire were from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Right.
That I couldn't go to the Union Leader. I couldn't go.
It was horrifying. This is the way of the world.
Yeah.
This is the way of the world.
Unbelievable.
The hopes of you know, the internet distributing journalism and finding its audience have really gone by the wayside.
Right.
Facebook and Google have transformed the business model for journalism. Even nonprofits like ourselves, we're a nonprofit. Any donation would be tax deductible. But even us, I mean, it changes our model. We're not going to get ads to support. It's hard to rely on foundations, which are fickle. Jeff Bezos isn't coming in and buying us. it's just not going to happen. So,
and you don't want Jeff Bezos, just the way you don't want
Bloomberg. Exactly. We don't want that either.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, you know, we really have to rely on support from our readers. And, this is an organization that's been around for 30 years, has a great legacy. And, the only way that it's been able to thrive is through reader support, and that's the way that journalism is going to be built in this century.
David, can I just add that one aspect of this that people in the audience really need to understand is the compared to what question? Because all the corporate media that they're hearing from, even the cable news, which is so-called, the good liberal station and the good conservative station, they're bought and paid for by corporate ownership. And their coverage is not 100% news. It's biased. And if the public wants to get real facts, they've got to go somewhere like you.
I'll give you a perfect example of that today. We published a piece by Max Moran.
It's incredible.
About Bloomberg News. So
this is an amazing piece, everyone. Go on.
Yeah. So Bloomberg, Michael Bloomberg is in the presidential race, spending $1 billion of his $52 billion fortune on television ads. And the Bloomberg News company, he owns one of the largest corporate media outlets in the country, has decided they're not going to investigate Michael Bloomberg or any of the Democratic candidates for the duration of the primary so that they don't have a conflict of interest. However, they turned over their opinion page to Peter Orszag, who used to be in the Obama administration. He ran the Office of Management and Budget, to say that large corporations, monopoly corporations, they're just more productive. And he based this on research that was written and underwritten by corporations who stand to benefit from more mergers. And that includes the company where Peter Orszag is CEO, Lazard, which is a boutique bank that consults on mergers and acquisitions.
Unbelievable.
So they're turning over their opinion page to a corporate, pro-corporate mindset that inevitably helps the general kind of attitude of someone like a Michael Bloomberg to get into power. So even when they're saying there's no conflict of interest, there's a conflict of interest.
So let me just
that's the kind of stuff that we write about who has power, what they're doing with it, and what the effects are.
So, first of all, you mentioned in one of your articles that and I think there are 7,000 journalists that are working for Bloomberg News around the world. So, and they've been told that they can't cover the 2020 campaign, at least the 2020 Democrats. They can't cover Bloomberg. Now we're finding out what Orszag is doing on the opinion page, which kind of makes me want to vomit. So, I'm just thinking, how do you maintain your integrity working for Bloomberg, being given those parameters? So let me just hear why. Let me just say something. I used to work for a commercial station. Most of my life has been spent in commercial radio. My last commercial job was at a radio station that was owned by a very conservative guy. When he handed me the paper that I was supposed to sign the contract, there were 3 pages of topics that I was not allowed to talk about. You can imagine what was on those pages. It was basically the environment. It was religion. It was like – and I looked at him and I said, why are you hiring me?
Right.
I mean, basically – and I just said, it ain't going to work. It ain't going to work.
Yeah.
This isn't going to – I mean, I was just so shocked. But at least he was upfront in telling me, well, I'm going to warn you now. If you talk about these, you'll get fired. But I'm going to tell you now before you sign the piece of paper. I mean, okay. And then I go listen to MSNBC, and I think this is really important. I want you to do this, David. So we're talking about the corporate interest and the corporate involvement, and you just mentioned what's going on with Bloomberg News, which is an amazing story. I posted both of them on Facebook. People need to read your piece and the piece that was just dropped today, because I think it's important, and Bloomberg needs to be answering these questions, even though he doesn't want to take questions. And that's this. MSNBC is clearly in the I don't want to do a very progressive candidate. They don't like Medicare for all. They don't like, and you know what nobody has done yet? I want to know how many ads run during the three-hour period of Morning Joe that are paid for by the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry. Because I want people to understand that there is a quid pro quo here, too. And that is that there is cash that ends up getting spent on MSNBC if we don't have Medicare for All. But guess what happens if we have Medicare for All? You're going to see those ads disappear.
And, you know, I mean, this has been true for years and years and years. You look at the Sunday shows and who the top donors are or the top advertisers, it's usually defense contractors. Now, you sitting at home are not in the position to buy a jet. Buy a fighter jet. There's no reason for Lockheed Martin to be doing advertising to the mass media, to the public, other than the fact
Good
that
point.
they're giving essentially an in-kind donation to the press, so that they aren't pushed on their issues.
Yeah.
So this is a problem this has been a problem for media for a long time. It's getting worse because Google and Facebook have just changed the game. They have taken all the revenues out of the print media and the digital media, and while doing very little to none of the work of journalism. Mm-hmm. And this has created a situation where if you want to be independent, if you want to be an independent media outlet that really reflects the will of the people, you have to go out to the public to get the support. There's no other option.
Yeah, I mean,
So that's why we've set this thing up, and we're trying to give people as much value as possible for their generous donations at prospect.org/subscribe. And, you know, I'm sure that you and every other independent media outlet, whether it's radio, print, digital, whatever, has to go through these conversations and these strategies as well.
But, you know, so as I'm thinking about this, you know, we're so upset about Donald Trump not showing his tax returns. And we're so upset about Donald Trump not walling himself off from his vast empire, whether it's true or not. How come Michael Bloomberg is getting such credibility and there isn't this chorus of pushback that not only is he a multi-billionaire, but and I understand the illusion that he's walling off Bloomberg News, but as you pointed out in the news story that dropped today, he really ain't. Why isn't he asked to disinvest himself from Bloomberg News? How can he run as a Democratic nominee and own one of the major organs of the media and think that all the critiques that we have of Donald Trump owns just some cheap real estate that I don't want to buy. But this is really important because look what he owns. And this is important
Absolutely.
Because it's news and information about what? About the economy.
Absolutely. I mean, what you're doing is you're taking one of the largest and most resource-rich news operations off the field.
Exactly. Off the field.
And we saw this during when Bloomberg was mayor, that Bloomberg News did not cover the New York City mayor's office. This is a huge problem, a crisis, really, for journalism. And because they have not applied the same issue or the same thing to Trump, they're still investigating Trump, but not investigating Bloomberg or the Democratic candidate. They've given a powerful talking point about the biased media to Trump.
Now,
Trump
beautiful.
Trump has banned Bloomberg News reporters from his rallies, and he's saying that this is proof that there's fake news out there. They're investigating me, but they're not investigating him. And so now this has become a liability in the presidential race.
Yes.
That just because of this man's ego, that he doesn't want to divest of this company. He thinks he can have it both ways. And this is now hurting the Democratic cause, I feel, in the presidential race.
Absolutely.
So this is a real, real problem And you know, I know people who work at Bloomberg, a lot of great, very talented journalists work there. They're in a very difficult position, and their boss put them there.
Well, let me just say, their boss put them there, but let's also say something else. Don't forget the meeting, was it in March or May, between Bezos and Bloomberg. Bezos owns what? The Washington Post. Bloomberg owns what? Bloomberg News. Do you think you're going to see that editorial that you just basically articulated verbally in the Washington Post? Do you think anybody will ever challenge Bloomberg about disinvesting on an editorial page in the Washington Post? No way.
You're playing into the hands of a conservative apparatus that says don't believe anything you read in the Washington Post or Bloomberg.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And all the reporting there that might be good is now functionally invalidated by this activity. So it's creating a crisis. Bloomberg should be called out on it.
Well, you see, this is the argument that you will not hear on the debate stage on the 19th. And this is one of the questions that should be asked.
You might hear it in the spin room because I'll be there.
Well, I'm definitely going to make sure you're in the spin room. But more importantly, this is a question that should be asked of those other candidates. You know, I know they're angry about his money. They're angry that he can go in and skip the first four primaries. They're angry about all that. But this is what they should be angry about. Because he is feeding legitimacy into the GOP line. And that should be their greater concern. Because the one thing they want to do is they want to drain that swamp, but they can't do it if Bloomberg is in the race.
That's right. That's right.
David. Do me a favor. Write something like this in the American Prospect. We will make sure that as many people as possible can see it, and we'll share it around everywhere from Facebook and Twitter, because I think it is the question that needs to be posed. Even though he's not on the debate stage, this is the question that proves he is such a liability, not just to the Democratic nomination, but frankly to journalism itself.
There's no question about it, and thank you for having me on.
It's a pleasure, David.
To talk about these issues and to make my little pitch for the Prospect.
Prospect.org.
Once again, it's prospect.org/subscribe.
And I just want everyone to remember that when you guys first started, you don't remember this, David, but when they first started, it was the Weekly Standard and the American Prospect, and everyone said they were the two little jewels. You're still standing. The Standard is gone. All right, ciao. Bye-bye. Take care.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye. All right, everyone. A little labor history. By the way, the Weekly Standard was the conservative version. The little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1946. That was the day federal judge T. Allen Goldsboro fined John L. Lewis $10,000 and the United Mine Workers $3.5 million. In what was characterized as a roaring courtroom scene, Lewis rose to challenge the judge to fine him whatever he wanted. The judge had just found Lewis and the UMW in contempt of court for ignoring his November 18th order to head off a soft coal strike, then in its 14th day. Judge Goldsboro had replaced his order with a temporary injunction after the government demanded a judgment that the strike was illegal and must end. Goldsboro ruled the strike was, quote, an evil, demonic, monstrous thing that meant hunger and cold, unemployment and destitution, a threat to democratic government itself. He insisted he was a friend of labor, but that Lewis should be sent to prison. UMW Chief Counsel Welly K. Hopkins snapped back defiantly, stating that the government was seeking to break the union politically, financially, and morally. The federal government had seized the mines in May and was now threatening to run them with Army engineers if Lewis didn't order miners back to work. AFL, CIO, and Railway Brotherhoods all rallied to Lewis's defense. The Detroit labor movement vowed a 24-hour general strike in support. But by the 7th, Lewis retreated, ordering miners back to work until March 31st. Facing the real threat of the Supreme Court action to uphold the $3.5 million fine, Lewis stated he wanted the court to, quote, be free from public pressure superinduced by the hysteria and frenzy of an economic crisis. Lewis and the UMW were tied up in appeals court for months while they attempted to negotiate new contract terms. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Poverty and violence in Central America are major factors driving migration to the United States. But there's another force that's often overlooked: climate change. Retired Lieutenant Commander Oliver Layton Barrett is with the Center for Climate and Security. He says in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, crime and poor economic conditions have long led to instability.
And when you combine that with protracted drought, it's just a stressor that makes everything worse.
He says with crops failing, many people have fled their homes.
These folks are leaving not because they're opportunists, because they are in survival mode. You have people that are legitimate refugees.
So Barrett supports allocating foreign aid to programs that help people in drought-ridden areas adapt to climate change.
There are nonprofits that are operating in those countries that have great ideas in terms of teaching farmers to use the land better, to harvest water better, to use different variety of crops that are more resilient to drought conditions. Those are the kinds of programs I think are needed.
So he says the best way to reduce the number of climate change migrants is to help people thrive in their home countries. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Everyone, I fought the law and the law won. So this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Ken Barnes picks our music. So who remind us who sings that song?
That is the fabulous Clash.
Wow. Yeah, they are
Clash.
The fabulous.
And it's of course, dedicated to Donald Trump, who fought the law, and one hopes that today is the beginning of the law winning.
So let me set the stage for what we're doing today, because I'm literally pulling this out of my socks. So I had a guest, and then the guest canceled. So then I made – I won't even tell you how many calls. I mean, I called Texas. I called John Nichols. I called Common Cause. I called Americans United for Separation of Churches. I must have made like 30 or 40 calls to get someone in at 12:30 today. And then literally in the last few minutes, people started calling me back, but it was like, you know, 15 minutes before the show, and I'm like, I can't handle this. So – you're listening to the hearings, maybe, maybe not. This show is airing during the impeachment hearings, and so therefore I'm sure not a lot of you aren't listening, but the show then re-airs all around the country at different times, plus we re-air tonight. And one of the greatest laments I've been hearing over and over again is that, you know, Adam Schiff dropped this remarkable report just the other night, and it's, you know, lots of pages long, and their concern is that nobody will read it. Well, Adam Schiff is kind of clever. So what Adam Schiff does is he's got a report, but there is a preface to the report. Then there is an executive summary to the report, and then there is a report. And when I called Ken this morning, I said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to do an annotated reading of the preface. And the reason we're going to do an annotated reading of the preface is that he basically tells the story three different ways. The short cliff note way is the preface. The more expanded book report way is the executive summary. And then the novel is the rest of the report. But it is a story over and over and over again with a little more added value and a little more added detail. And Ken, what did you say to me when I said we're going to read the preface out loud? Because you said, this is something I learned.
That's what we learn when we're trained as lawyers. That's right. Why Adam Schiff is so good at this.
Yep.
You learn, you tell them what they're going to hear. Then you let them hear it, and then you tell them again what they just heard,
right.
And you tell them early and often.
Right, early and often. And so I have said this over and over again, everyone, that you teach children through repetition. No, everyone learns that way. That's what you need to do.
Yeah, not just children.
And that's one of the reasons why we know we keep hearing about the fact that Nancy Pelosi has passed 400 bills in the House. Who gives a crap? Who knows what they are? Because they go over to the Senate and they end up in the circular file. While the way people know about all the work and all the good work, the vision of the Democrats in the Congress is that you start doing informational ads. Did you know about this bill? It didn't get anywhere because of him. You know about this bill? It didn't get anywhere. We could have helped you in Kentucky. We could have helped you in Iowa. We could have helped you here. But it didn't get anywhere because what happens? Moscow Mitch does not want to address the needs of America. We did the heavy lift, but you can't clap with one hand. All right? And that's what they need to do. And that is something they have never done. They somehow – I don't know. I don't understand why they are offended by marketing, but I am not. I am not offended by that. I love repetition. I learn from it. So one
of
the
things – that's what politicians do when they're running for office.
Oh, yeah,
of course. They're marketing themselves.
Absolutely.
So this is just intelligent marketing.
But and now is it intelligent? When I would go into a room as a politician, and I would know the room. Mm-hmm. I would always start with a different story that related to the place or space I was. But then I would thread in my policies and my story to that space. So there was always the repetition of the content, but the invitation in and the beginning of the conversation was always slightly different. One, because people are like, wow, she knows me. Or, wow, she understands this environment, or whatever it was. So I needed to first make a connection before I then made the pitch. And to a large extent, the Democrats, I mean, they sit on these stories that are so powerful. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hear about 400 bills if I don't know what they are. Mm-hmm. You know, give me the top 20, you know, and tell me why this state would care about this bill and why what the Senate is doing is so horrific. You know,
it
connects the dots for them. Anyway, so what I told Ken is I'm going to read the preface to you. It's only about 5 or 6 pages long. I'm going to leave out some of the thank yous because they go on and on and on. But Ken, I want you to stop because it's an annotated reading. So we can sort of explode with, wow, isn't that interesting? Or, wow, let me read that one again. All right. And thank you, Adam Schiff, because you did a very effective job of sharing with an audience, if they choose to listen or read, what they need to understand about what happened. He begins this way. This report reflects the evidence gathered thus far by the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, in coordination with the Committee on Oversight and Reform and the Committee on Foreign Affairs, as part of the House of Representatives impeachment inquiry into Donald J. Trump, the 45th President of the United States. It is the culmination of an investigation that began in September of 2019, not that long ago, and intensified over the past 3 months as new revelations and evidence of President's misconduct towards Ukraine emerged. The committee pursued the truth vigorously but fairly, ensuring the full participation of both parties throughout the probe. It was sustained by the tireless work of more than 36 dedicated staff members, and then he goes on about the 100 hours of depositions, the 17 witnesses, yada, yada, yada. I'm going to skip over everyone he thanks because he thanks a lot of people, and I'm going to go into
this. By the
this.
Way, we have recognized and thanked the many public servants previously whose willingness to come forward despite being bullied by Donald Trump.
Absolutely.
Shows great heroism and patriotism.
And I think a lot of those people are going to be mentioned during the course of the preface. So not to worry. We're going to touch on them.
Mm-hmm.
But these are some of the backbenchers that you will never see, that don't go home anymore for Thanksgiving, that don't go home at night because they understand the importance of the moment and they are dedicated, despite their salaries, to making sure that they're there into the wee hours of the night, sometimes with a sleeping bag in their office. So I want to know that's absolutely true and I want people to know that.
Right.
All right. He begins this way. In his farewell address, President George Washington warned of a moment when the, quote, cunning, ambitious, and unprincipled men will be enabled to subvert the power of the people and to usurp for themselves the reins of government, destroying afterwards the very engines which have lifted them to unjust dominion. Begins with George. The framers of the Constitution well understood that an individual could one day occupy the office of the president who would place his personal or political interests above those of the nation. Having just won hard-fought independence from a king with unbridled authority, they were attuned to the dangers of an executive who lacked fealty to the law and the Constitution. And think about that. The king says, I am the law.
Right.
You don't need to worry about the law because I am the law. And to a large extent, what you hear with Donald Trump is you don't need to worry about policy. You don't need to worry about the Constitution. I am the word. You know, right. I am the law. If it's coming out of my mouth, then you must believe me.
He sounds just like Louis the 16th before he got his head chopped off. You know, l'état c'est moi.
The state is me. Exactly right. In response, the framers, and this is so amazing because Donald Trump doesn't understand. He feels and acts so king-like that they clearly envisioned a Donald. Think about this. The framers knew a Donald because they just met him. He was called the king.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. In response, the framers adopted a tool used by the British Parliament for several hundred years to constrain the crown, the power of impeachment. Unlike in Britain, where impeachment was typically reserved for inferior officers, but not the king himself, impeachment in our untested democracy was specifically intended to serve as the ultimate form of accountability for a duly elected president. Isn't that interesting? So they had this, but they couldn't use it on the king.
Right.
And since they were replacing a king with an elected president, guess what? It had to be applying to a president.
Well, the founders wanted to make darn sure that we weren't going to go back to having a king.
Exactly.
Been
right.
There, done that.
Don't you love George Washington? Because they would, in some ways, wanted him to be king. And he knew to step aside.
Right.
Oh, my God. His gift goes on and
right.
on.
Right. What heroism. Compare that with the current incumbent.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Rather than a mechanism to overturn an election, impeachment was explicitly contemplated as a remedy of last resort for a president who fails to faithfully execute his oath of office, quote, to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Now, understand, it isn't about elections. It's about behavior in office. That's the most – I don't care about 2020. It's not about 2016 right now. It's about how he's behaving and throwing our nation under the bus now. It is of the moment. It is not of elections. I think that is something that people don't get when they keep saying, oh, but we have 2020 coming up. It has nothing to do with an election. It really doesn't. It's
right.
Shocking.
Well, it's George, the first paragraph of this preface where he talks about George Washington worrying about people who were elected through a democratic process.
Then,
but then once they're there and they have the power, they just sort of make sure that they keep staying in power. They subvert the elections they subvert democracy.
Oh, God. Accordingly, so we go. Accordingly, the Constitution confers the power to impeach the president on Congress, stating that the president shall be removed from office upon conviction for treason, bribery, or other crimes and misdemeanors.
High crimes and
misdemeanors. High crimes. Thank you so much. I'm thinking right now it doesn't even matter. High, low, medium.
Well, it doesn't even have to be a crime.
It doesn't even have to be a crime. Exactly. While the constitutional standard for removal from office is justly a high one, it is nonetheless an essential check and balance on the authority of the occupant of the office of the president, particularly when the occupant represents a continuing threat to our fundamental democratic norms, values, and laws. Alexander Hamilton explained that impeachment was not designed to cover only criminal violations, your point, monsieur,
yes,
but also crimes against the American people. Now, understand that that's exactly what a president has the power to do. You and I can't do it the way he can do it. That's why it doesn't have to be criminal, because it's only vested in the authority and the power of the president. Therefore, it's not going to be on a book, but it's going to be in high crimes and misdemeanors according to the Constitution and the analysis of that behavior. Quote, the subjects of its jurisdiction, Hamilton wrote, are those offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public men, or in other words, from the abuse or violation of some public trust. They are of a nature which may, with peculiar propriety, be denominated political, as they relate chiefly to injuries done immediately to the society itself. I mean, it is so vested in the politics and the power of the person.
Right.
That's what people don't understand. When I rob a bank, it's really obvious what's going on, you know, and you can write a law about it. But what a president does, given their authority and their power and their ability to sort of undermine a society, how do you write that into – there is no
right,
law.
Right.
Really.
You or I could go rob a bank, not that we want to, or go commit any other crime, any – person can go do that. But we don't have the power of the presidency. We can't go to a foreign country like Ukraine and say our Congress allocated $400 million to aid you, but I'm the president and I have the sole power to decide not to actually give it to you.
So, you know, I was thinking about –
You and I can't do that, Arnie.
So Duncan Hunter spent $250,000 of his campaign money or whatever his money is for his own personal use, okay? And so now he'll probably go to jail. All right, we know he's been found guilty. And to a large extent, what Donald Trump did with the military aid was kind of, you know, temporarily use it for his own personal use. Mm-hmm. That's what this was for. This was for his own personal use for his reelection campaign. Now, it was temporary, okay? I mean, maybe Duncan Hunter could have paid back the $250,000. The fact that he took it out and went on a trip is a problem, you know? But that's really what this is. He used the congressional money that was assigned to Ukraine as a way of threatening the Ukrainian president to produce a document or at least a CNN interview basically saying they were going to investigate the Bidens. And that was done not for the good of the country, not for the stability and the safety and the security of Ukraine and the United States. It was done for him.
For Trump. Solely.
It's just shocking.
And it really is a ridiculous excuse to make that, oh, gee, the money was paid in full or paid back with interest on the loans and stuff. You know, the bank robbers, after they get caught, they actually give the money back or the police take it back. And just because I rob you, Arnie, I take all the money out of your wallet and I'm caught by the police and we give it back. And maybe I even am ordered to pay it with interest. That doesn't mean I didn't commit the crime of robbing you.
So you know, I've been thinking about it. I've been posting a lot on Facebook and getting beat up. And one of the things I've been posting about is the fact that nobody did a perp walk after 2008 and that we bailed out Wall Street. And everyone says, oh, but it's okay, Arnie. We bailed them out, but they paid us back with interest.
That's what I'm talking about.
It's exactly my point. Mm-hmm. And so as you were saying that, and I'm thinking about, but think about the people that were harmed when we basically raped the economy. Were they paid back? Were they made whole? Think about the people that died in Ukraine because the money didn't come in a timely fashion and people knew it and there were dozens if not hundreds of people that died. There were consequences to delay.
Yeah.
There was a consequence to what they did to the economy. The fact that they paid it back with interest, screw you. That doesn't fix what you did wrong. It doesn't fix what he did wrong.
In other words, it's still wrong.
It's still
– even if you got caught and had to – release the $400 million
it's
to Ukraine, or even
wrong.
If I took your wallet and I give the money back when the police catch me.
It's still wrong.
It's still wrong.
Thank you. I want someone to say that. That's the refrain during these hearings today.
And people need to be held accountable.
That, right,
but
exactly.
For doing something wrong. That's the whole point of this, I think, is that people need to be held accountable. And
still
if we
wrong.
Don't impeach someone who does these things, then – there's no accountability. The next president or this president next year can do the same thing.
I'm appalled. Similarly, he goes on in his preface, future Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court, James Wilson, a delegate from Pennsylvania at the Constitutional Convention, distinguished impeachable offenses from those that reside within the sphere of ordinary jurisprudence, what you've been saying. Uh-huh. As he noted, impeachments, listen to these words, impeachments are confined to political characters, to political crimes and misdemeanors, and to political punishments. A political punishment is removal, folks. I'm just telling you right now.
Mm-hmm.
As this report details, the impeachment inquiry has found that President Trump personally and acting through agents within and outside of the U.S. government solicited the interference of a foreign government, Ukraine, to benefit his reelection. In furtherance of this scheme, President Trump conditioned official acts on a public announcement by the new Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, of politically motivated investigations, including one into President Trump's domestic political opponent.
And the key word, I think, is official acts.
Yes.
He made his official act, which he – only the president can do this act. It's
right.
An official act in the course of your duties as president. And he made it conditioned on the Ukrainians doing something that benefits him personally as Donald Trump.
So his shakedown – he claimed that his shakedown was an official act. And that's what he said. I mean, in a way, this is how he packaged it. This is an official act. It may feel like a shakedown. It may look like a shakedown, but it's an official act. No, it's a shakedown. And therefore, it's not an official act. That's another reason for your impeachment.
Mm-hmm. I mean, well, but it was an official act in the sense that Congress had allocated the money,
right,
and Trump was supposed to spend it and give it to the Ukraine in aid, mm-hmm, to keep the Russians off of their eastern border.
Right.
So it was an official act. He was acting as in his official capacity as president to withhold the aid that had been allocated, and he was using it to shake down the,
right,
Ukrainians to do something for me.
But
it's
the,
like
the,
a payoff.
The act was to give the money to the Ukrainians. The shakedown was holding the money and not giving it to,
right,
them until they changed their behavior.
Right.
And their behavior was to open up an investigation into the Bidens. And he goes on to say, in pressuring President Zelensky to carry out his demand, President Trump withheld a White House meeting desperately sought by the Ukrainian president and critical U.S. military assistance to fight Russian aggression in eastern Ukraine. Let's not forget Zelensky had just been elected.
Yeah.
Let's not forget he ran on an anti-corruption campaign. Let's not forget he had no political history. He was a comedian and an actor. He was a comedian. I mean, this is the other problem,
right,
is this guy was so desperate for some kind of official acknowledgement for someone so important as Donald Trump.
And also his country, Ukraine, needed some kind of recognition of support from the White House that the United States would stand behind,
yeah,
the Ukrainian government,
right,
with the elected Ukrainian government,
because
they were being invaded by soldiers, Russian soldiers in the east.
Ukraine was at war with Russia.
Yeah, yeah. So Zelensky wanted some way of showing the world, including Putin, that, hey, I've got friends. I've got powerful friends. The United States is having me in the White House, and they're going to make sure that Ukraine stays free and democratic.
But more than even Putin and the world, he had to prove it to the Ukrainians.
And to the Ukrainians.
Please understand,
that's
he had
true.
Just gotten elected.
Mm-hmm.
He'd gotten elected on this. He knew that Congress had passed this military support. He knew, mm-hmm, all this. What Trump was doing was taking a man who was so desperate for credibility and understanding his vulnerability. I mean, what Trump is so good at is he plays people's vulnerabilities. He knows exactly what they are, and then he basically manipulates them. And that's what he was seeing, was an opportunity to manipulate this new young elected president and be able to use him,
right,
for his own benefit. And that's what he was doing.
And who was Zelensky afraid of besides the Russian soldiers in the east? The Ukraine had its own issues with oligarchs,
right,
who were trying to and had succeeded in a large part in prior years to corrupt the government and to basically make the Ukrainian government work for the oligarchs and enrich themselves. And indeed, that's what Paul Manafort's job was before,
right, exactly,
he became the campaign manager for Donald
nothing,
Trump.
For nothing. Remember, he was the campaign manager for nothing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sure, I believe that one. Anyway, the president engaged in this course of conduct for the benefit of his own presidential reelection, to harm the election prospects of a political rival, and to influence our nation's upcoming presidential election to his advantage. In doing so, the president placed his own personal and political interests above the national interests of the United States, sought to undermine the integrity of the U.S. presidential election process, and endangered U.S. national security. At the center of this investigation is the memorandum prepared following President Trump's July 25, 2019 phone call with Ukraine's president, which the White House declassified and released under significant public pressure. The call record alone is stark evidence of misconduct, a demonstration of the president's prioritization of his personal political benefit over the national interest. In response to President Zelensky's appreciation for vital U.S. military assistance, which President Trump froze without explanation, President Trump asked for, quote, a favor, though, close quote, two specific investigations designed to assist his reelection efforts. Our investigation determined that this telephone call was neither the start nor the end of President Trump's efforts to bend U.S. foreign policy for his personal gain. Rather, it was a dramatic crescendo within a months-long campaign driven by President Trump, in which senior officials, including everyone, check off this list, the Vice President, the Secretary of State, the Acting Chief of Staff, the Secretary of Energy, and others, were either knowledgeable or active participants in an effort to extract from a foreign nation the personal political benefits sought by the president. You know what's so shocking here is that everyone had an integrity lobotomy. Everybody sold out. You know, we right. I, this is awful, but I go back to the people that did speak up when they saw what happened at the Holocaust and all the people that knew. And you keep thinking, how could they have done it? How could they have checked their souls and their integrity and their belief in right and wrong? And then you look at this situation, which in some ways is so obvious. And there are so many reasons for them to turn in, so many people that were ready to embrace them for acknowledging the failure. And they didn't. They didn't. Oh, that's the part that breaks my heart, is to see what these people have done. Anyway, everyone, I just want to let you know, we're going to end this right now, but you only have another 5 pages left to go. I mean, this is just the preface, everyone. I recommend if you read anything, read the preface. It ends on page 12. We're on the end of page 8. The end of page 8. Read at least to page 12. And you will have a better handle on what you're hearing, what you're seeing, and what you can share over a coffee at the Dunkin' Donuts. That's all I have to say.
And part of it that you really need to take in from Adam Schiff is the decision to move forward with an impeachment inquiry is not one we took lightly. Yeah. Under the best of circumstances, impeachment is a wrenching process for the nation. I resisted calls to undertake an impeachment investigation for many months on that basis, notwithstanding the existence of presidential misconduct that I believe to be deeply unethical and damaging to our democracy. The alarming events and actions detailed in this report, however, left us with no choice but to proceed. So it's not that anybody's looking forward to this, not that anybody's trying
to force their hand. The day after the Mueller report, what happened? Basically, everything that we're sort of talking about now with Ukraine. He thought, see, look at how successful I was with Mueller. Watch me. I'm on a roll. Well, I'm hoping you roll someplace too. All right, everyone, we're going to end with Justice Day by
Rebel Fire.
Here we go.
You're the boot stomping on the human face forever. You're the eye staring down on everyone and ever seeing all. You're the lie twisting all our minds into your whoredom. You were death, you were war, you were slavery.